Thanks for clicking on our podcast. This is John Fraser, and with my partner in wine down in the Cape, Michael Olivier, each week we taste the very best that the Cape has to offer in wines or spirits, whatever tickles our fancy, and hopefully it'll tickle yours as well. Well, in this week's Divine Intervention, we return to the land of bubbles, to a sparkling wine from the Cape that I am sure, I am confident, we will find is every bit as good as some of that overpriced French muck you find being imported. And after all, with a fairly strong rand, French bubbly has become quite expensive for many South Africans. No need at all, because there are some wines made here in the Cape that are every bit as good. But before I introduce the wine, we will pop down to Cape Town to talk to our wine guru, our food and wine guru, Michael Olivier. Michael, good evening and welcome.
John, thank you. Lovely to be back with you again.
And thanks again for agreeing to talk us through yet another gem from the Cape. Just so you know, Michael, and our listeners know as well, with me in the Joburg studio, we have Malcolm McDonald from Tessos. Malcolm, great to see you again.
Great to be here, John.
And writer, brander, all sorts of stuff. He's had a very long and varied career. And this, of course, is the high point for him. Jeremy Sampson from Interbrand Sampson de Villiers. Jeremy, great to chat to you again.
Thanks, John. Always delighted to be with you.
And okay, that's enough. You know who the human beings are. Now for the bit of creativity. It's a wine from Pedeberg. It's a Brut Reserve, or Bru Reserve if you want to be very French, made in the Champagne method. So it's a Méthode Cap Classique. It's a Chenin Blanc grape, and it's 2012. I've told them all about it, Michael, but maybe you can tell them what it tastes like.
Well, John, it always amazes me how, you know, Pedeberg call themselves the home of Chenin Blanc. But the one thing that always amazes me about this grape is how diverse it is, and what, you know, anything from a really dry, bubbly like this to a Girapigo. And it is our largest planted white grape. This is a lovely example of an excellent Méthode Cap Classique. The color is lovely, that sort of slight sort of greenish tint around the edges, and this lovely fine bubbles rushing up to the top of the glass. You get your nose in there, you get the sort of classic Granny Smith apples and sort of citrus, limey, grapefruity, a little bit of pear going on there as well. It's quite fresh, it's quite subtle, it's elegant, it's pure, it's got a nice minerality to it, and on the aftertaste it has that sort of yeasty, brioche kind of finish. Obviously as the wine gets older, it's now 2 years old, but you know, give it another 2 years or so, it'll just become more complex and more tasty.
And of course, Michael, you made a very important point. This is not a traditional grape with which, for instance, a champagne would be made. It's not a Pinot Noir or a Chardonnay. It is, as you say, South Africa's most widely grown grape, which some people tend to look down on a bit. Nice to see that you can make a noble bubbly out of it.
No, you can, absolutely. I mean, you know, some of the wines, particularly Pedeberg, you know, that Dryland collection, Chenin Blanc of theirs is absolutely stunning. No, you could make really outstanding wine from Chenin Blanc.
Well, that is to be determined by our panel, of course. So, Malcolm McDonald, what do you make of this?
Loving it. I'm getting the fresh, really fresh flavor from this, and I love a dry champagne. Well, I'm not allowed to say that, am I? But anyway, whatever.
Of course you're allowed to say. You can say what you
like. I can say whatever I like, right? I've got freedom of speech still. So, really, really tasty. I'm enjoying it a lot. I don't like the sweets, the sweet version. So this is really just suiting me very nicely.
Well, I have to say, Malcolm, I was looking at a picture on Twitter of a farewell event which was being hosted at Business Day for Peter Bruce, the editor, and the group editor who's about to head off on a sabbatical. And I noticed they had a bottle of bubbly in the photo, and I noticed it was, I'll be I'll be nice. It was cheap and cheerful. It was nowhere near this quality. So it's nice to know that the Divine Intervention podcast is a notch or 20 above that that humble publication. But what do I know? Certainly, I agree with you. I like the way it's toasty, it's yeasty, it's dry, it's not sweet. This is an elegant wine, certainly standing in the ambassadorial gatherings that I'm used to attending on an almost daily basis. I would have no problem quaffing this, but I think it would go well with food as well. But before we ask Michael about that, we must ask the opinion of our youthful and bubbly Jeremy Sampson.
John, how do I follow that?
most people leave, actually.
I must say that Paerdeberg, as Michael, you've alluded to, I think of as Chenin Blanc, and I've enjoyed it for many years. It's one of my favourite, in fact, Chenin Blanc is just about my favourite cultivar. I have to say Mrs. Sampson prefers white wine, so it stunts my style at times. But this is the first time I've enjoyed the MCC. Interesting as well how they're, you know, I always look at the branding and seeing how they're picking up, is it a zebra or a quagga?
Yes.
They've got a close-up of the side of the quagga, if that's what it is, the stripes on the label. So there's a nice link. But again, as Malcolm says, it's absolutely delicious. I'm looking at these little bubbles rising to the top. We've got like a thin rim of froth coming through, but it's absolutely delicious. And I think this is where people must be encouraged more and more to drink South African, whether it's MCC or whatever. We really have so many delights that most of us don't know about.
I thought the MCC was an English cricket club, but...
the Marylebone Cricket Club, old chap.
Yeah, I think this certainly doesn't send you to sleep as fast as cricket does, so I enjoy it. Michael, back to that discussion that I was about to launch on what to eat with this. I think this would go well with a whole variety of food.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, the zebra on the label, Jeremy, is Paerdeberg Horse Mountain, and there were zebras that used to roam on those mountains in the earlier times.
Before they ate them all.
this is a wine that could literally go with anything. It would be great with seafood, with nice fresh oysters. I think it could go quite well with cheese as well. I think a nice, mildly oozy brie or something would go quite well. Lovely with sushi too, I think. It's just nice as an aperitif wine on a Sunday morning.
I like your idea of cheese, Michael. I think that classic pairing of port and cheese is maybe fading a little, although I do still love it, and I do still love to call port, even if we're not really allowed to call some of the ports produced in the Cape port anymore because of those silly Eurocrats. So let's continue calling port, occasionally have it with cheese, and on occasions when we fancy a method cap classique or a champagne, we can do that as well. Just one question, Michael. Before we started this recording, you and Jeremy were having a chat off air about vintages, and that's an issue which I think is pretty important in the wine worlds. And Jeremy made the case. In fact, I'll ask him to make it again, that maybe Europeans and others are more obsessed with the year in which a wine was made than we in South Africa. Jeremy, that was, as I understood you, what you were saying.
Exactly, John. You know, if you look at Bordeaux, for instance, most people who know anything about wine will tell you, oh, this is the vintage, that's rubbish. I happen to know that 2013 is rubbish. Now, I've even seen, I think it's Peter Seychelles Jr., saying, avoid Bordeaux 2013 unless you really know what you're looking at, because it's going to be rubbish. But I think it's taken quite some time, and it's only people like Michael around here who understand, you know, the different years and how things have changed. I suppose in the past, perhaps we blended more, I don't know, so that you could actually sometimes cover up difficult years. Whereas now we're having an improvement in our quality, and people are becoming more discerning. So as you say, the vintage is much more important.
And Michael, just remind us a few of the factors which might make one year a superior year to another in terms of the quality of wine that's produced.
Wow. There are a number of them. I mean, first of all, the way you prune in late winter, you know, how many bunches are you going to have per vine? Obviously, less less bunches, greater color, greater flavor. Then is the wind going to blow during blossoming time? Are the vines going to be able to pollinate properly? What sort of weather are you going to have in early summer? I mean, I'll never forget the summer of 1977 when a number of the winemakers and wine farmers were all down in Hermanus on holiday and we had an absolute whack of downy mildew. And it ruined the vintage for that year. But and then, of course, you've got, you know, what happens in early summer? What happens if you have great heat in January, and then it sort of cools off a little bit in February, or you have a cool, rainy January, and a February that is a February from hell? All those things make huge differences. The way you cut your canopy over your grapes, the exposure of the bunch to the sun, all those things have a huge influence on the vintage. If you've got a big brand that is non-vintage and sells, you blend it so that it tastes like last year's one or the year before or the year before. But if you've got a small little unit, that's going to make a huge difference.
It's funny, Michael, you remember 1977 for a wine vintage. I remember it for the Sex Pistols. It shows how very different we are. I remember the excitement the first time I heard a Sex Pistols single. But this is a wine tasting podcast, so let's move rapidly on to Malcolm McDonald. Malcolm, I know that you have a very sophisticated palate when it comes to wine, and you tend to buy and lay down red wine. To what extent will you look at the producer and the cultivar before you look at the vintage, or is the vintage something that comes into your calculation when you're shopping for a wine?
It's something that's sort of been incidental. It's more the producer that I look at, and you get some that you trust in. But obviously, every now and again, you'll taste a wine from them, and it's not great. And then the vintage comes into play, and you say, well, okay, so be aware of that one. Stay away from it.
And of course, Jeremy, that's why wine guides like the well-known Platter Guide in South Africa can be useful, because they do quite often give ratings for different vintages, and you will be able to see which one was a stellar vintage, maybe compared to years before and after.
John, you're absolutely right, but I find that vintages has got a lot of mystique, because often we don't get guides that go back far enough, especially with the red wines. But the other thing I often wonder about is how long to keep wines. Now, there's the argument that once it's for sale, retail, then it's drinkable. And then you hear from other people, especially with French wines, well, you shouldn't touch them for the first 5 years or so. And that's where I think you need someone like a Michael around to guide you on not just the vintage, but how long you should keep it. And if it's going to be past its best, say, in 10 years, I don't know.
Well, the trouble is I can't always take a Michael along with me when I'm doing my supermarket shopping. Would that I could. As you know, Michael, I have occasionally SMS'd or rung you for a bit of advice on a wine list or in a restaurant. But I won't suggest that all of our several million podcast listeners do the same, because you've just become a one-man phone answering operation.
Absolutely.
which would be cruel. But just returning to this, there is champagne or bubbly, and there is vintage bubbly, presumably because of the price difference, with vintage bubblies tending to be more expensive. One expects those to be of better quality.
Not necessarily better quality, but certainly the features of the climatic features of the vintage will show. You know, maybe they've had an absolutely brilliant year in Champagne with lots of sunshine, etc., and they produce a great wine, so they give it a vintage. Essentially, with those really big champagne houses, what they're trying to do is that, you know, at your christening, at your confirmation, at your engagement, at your wedding, at the birth of your first child, that bottle of Moët and Chandon is going to taste exactly the same over all those years. So, you know, I think that vintage is important in certainly in European terms. I've tasted recently back to 2007 at Cabernet Franc at Oldenburg, and the variance from vintage to vintage is quite marked, with the wines getting older, with the winemaker varying his oaking regime to allow the fruit to perform more. And you know, my first assessment of the 2008 was that it was brilliant, and everybody said no, the 2009 is better. And then I went back to the 2009 half an hour later, and there suddenly there it was, a better wine in the glass. So I think vintage is important in the case of the smaller producers.
And I have to say, Michael, I remember when I was living in Belgium, there was a restaurant where I believe the cellar had been sealed up while the Germans were occupying the country, and had only, this was maybe 10, 15 years ago, only recently been opened up, and they had some pre-war bottles of red wine, which they were selling for a very, very low price, with an assurance that if it really had gone bad, they'd bring you another one. So I remember drinking this unidentifiable wine, because the label had completely eroded from it. It was just the glass bottle with unknown contents. But one or two of those were really quite superb. And they do show that if stuff is left alone in a quiet environment with a fairly constant temperature, sometimes you can improve wine, or even if it goes slightly off, it can be interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, for sure.
Jeremy, I won't ask you the oldest wine you've tried, but have you ever looked at a wine list and thought, gosh, if I had an extra couple of zeros on my credit card, I wouldn't mind buying one of those 1940s or 1950s vintage reds from Bordeaux or Burgundy?
Well, I'm reading a book at the moment, which I believe has a certain notoriety in the wine industry, about Lafitte Rothschild and Chateau Petrus from the 1700s-1800s. And I must say it's a fascinating read, and I'm trying to work out in my mind how much of it is novel and how much is actually fact. Because you know, they say, well, you can examine, as you mentioned, the label and the printing techniques and the paper. You can look at the bottle and the engraving, you'd look at the cork or the seal. And you know, I'm thinking, what's it going to be like if it's 20, 50, 100, a couple of hundred years old? And I think, to be blunt, the oldest wine I've drunk is probably not more than about 15 years. And I went to a vertical tasting, I think it was Bouchard Finlayson in Johannesburg last year, where they went through the Chardonnays of about the last decade. And as Michael said, it really is fascinating noting the difference from year to year.
My problem with vertical tastings is I always end up horizontal afterwards, but maybe that's just me. Final thought from Malcolm MacDonald. Well, were you given an unlimited budget and able to shop in the finest wine houses and off licences and what do they call them in Britain? Négociants, maybe that's in Burgundy. But people what sell wine. If you were able to really browse around some of these producers, would you think it a worthwhile exercise to maybe go back a couple of decades and see how something that was young and fresh and fruity in its youth has become mature and elegant, a bit like our friend Mr. Sampson?
I think if budget was not an issue, I'd probably buy a whole lot of stuff I knew and liked well. And then keep some aside to explore strange and interesting and old and different things. So not necessarily just old, but a variation of different characteristics that I might discover the next thing that I'll enjoy and stock up on.
Of course, I suppose the twin investment philosophy is one, buy lots of nice wine, and two, buy a good health plan so that you can live long enough to enjoy it. Jeremy, you wanted a final word.
Well, as everyone now knows that I'm sort of well advanced in years, I just want to refer to the fact that I first went to Bordeaux in 1965, which means I'm not exactly 21, but I was lucky enough to be taken around the Medoc area and Saint-Emilion, and we were taken around to Haubriard, Chateau Haubriard, and Chateau La Mission Haubriard. Now, this was in August 1965, and they said that to be very, very careful of the 64 vintage because hail had gone through the area. And they said, unless you know what you're buying, be very, very careful. And I think it comes back to what we were saying earlier. The weather can play a part, but also if you don't know what you're buying, you can pay an awful lot of money for a label and find that actually it's not the greatest year.
Well, unfortunately, this was one of our greatest podcast wine tastings, but we are out of time again. So many thanks to Michael Olivier for suggesting the Pedeberg Winery Brut Reserve Chenin Blanc 2012. Many thanks to our studio guests, Jeremy Sampson. Great to see you again.
Thanks, John.
And to Malcolm McDonald.
Thank you.
And of course, down in the Cape, to our food and wine guru, Michael Olivier. Michael, great to chat to you again.
John, thanks so much.
I'm John Fraser. This has been Divine Intervention.